Welcome to the podcast of the Urban Mystic, the show where we explore and work out a theology and practice of intimacy with God. Our goal is to help people develop a practice of the presence of God in order to attain spiritual maturity and independence from religious service providers. Such maturity and independence can only be attained through being securely rooted in a direct, close, and intimate relationship with God. It is here that faith and intimacy are, by their respective definitions, contrasted and explored. It has been quite a while since I've published an episode. This is in part due to the challenges of Steve and myself trying to align our schedules across time zones and also manage the various competing demands that we have for our respective time and energy. After finishing season 5, both of us needed a break from recording and got wrapped up in life. We prioritized our friendship and trusted that we'd return to recording when the time is right. And return we have. I'd like to just begin this episode by apologizing for the sound quality in this episode. I tried a new avenue for recording the sessions between Steve and I, and there's some mismatch in terms of the sound quality, especially the sound levels throughout this episode. In wrestling with the idea of the way forward, I've had is to try to put into word who is the podcast for and what are we doing with it. The idea is to enable people to understand what relational spirituality is, especially centered around mysticism as the practice of relational union with God. To find a way to move from, in the past, us having explored particular problems that we faced related to church and individual spirituality. And, you know, as we've delved into in the past, we've really highlighted that this thing of intimacy with God is really hard to define because it is so poorly defined and so poorly understood. And it's really not a part of our contemporary religious and spiritual practices. And so on a level, I feel like it's important for us to recognize that there's a distinction between three things that actually overlap and tie together. And it's very easy to see them as one and the same because a lot of the language is shared in common between them. And so there's a large point where religion, spirituality, and mysticism overlap. But then where they don't connect with each other, they actually receive some distinctives on their own. They share a lot in common because it's people. It's people in relation with nature, themselves, each other, and the divine as broadly defined. But religion really becomes about our institutions, our traditions, the history, what people pass on from one generation to another and collect. And that becomes part of the way people gather and do practices together. When it's taken to the extreme, it doesn't include the personal and it doesn't include the mystical. Spirituality is about relationships, which is one of the reasons why we land at relational spirituality as such a strong term between us. But taken to the extreme, spirituality is just about the individual and what they're living into and what they're practicing. It's disconnected from religion. It's disconnected from mysticism. And I think similarly, and that's why there's so much in common between them, because religion is about the people and the divine and what they share. Spirituality is the spirituality about the deeper living and loving. But we draw a lot from that, from the big stories that are told to us from religion, and a lot about, you know, who and what the divine is and how we're pursuing it. And yet mysticism comes into its own when we think of the distinctive of when we speak about who or what we think of as God or the divine and the language that we use around that. Taken to the extreme, we ignore religion, we ignore spirituality, and it's all about God. And in truth, there's some measure of those, because as any community forms, you end up with things that are religious, no matter how spiritual they are, how mystical they are. And so that's, I think, by way of just some kind of like loose definition or passing out of those. But when it comes to mysticism, there's been a strong evolution of the term. And I find that some people respond very positively to the word, and some people respond quite negatively to the word mystic or mysticism. And I think a large part of that is related to which version of the word that they've been given. And so when we use the word between you and I, there's ways in which we're understanding that can differ from other people. Where the word mystic comes from differs to how it's been defined in different eras. And for instance, if you're dealing with someone whose theology is very rooted in the 16th century the word mystic is used in a particular way there, and often they'll react. I remember for my master's trying to have a conversation with someone about John Wesley being a mystic, and they were just like, that just shut the conversation down. They're like, John Wesley was not a mystic. Mysticism, you know, evil, bad. Like, that was at the end of the conversation. We couldn't really continue. And that was an academic as well, which I found, well, let me not just, he was a theologian, which doesn't mean that he's necessarily an academic. So basically, you know, when we think back on it, it does go back to the early Greek word mystikos, which means to conceal or to be mysterious. And it's strongly related in that context to the mystery religions, where there was a secret and you needed to be initiated into the secrets in order to see it. And then things would be shared with you and you enter into these hidden practices. But then there's a big gap, and it gets picked up by people in the desert as they're thinking about God and as they're thinking about their reflections of God. And they provide us initially with something called mystical theology, which is an alternative. In a sense, it's the heart and the lifeblood of theology throughout the ages. And yet it's not something that's received a lot of focus by modern and contemporary Christians. And that's quite an interesting history in and of itself, but it's not directly relevant here. But the word mystic itself, as we understand it, only actually appears in English in the 16th century. So it appears in the 16th century, but by the 17th century, it starts to be used in a very broad sense to describe anyone who's got a deep spiritual understanding. That borrows in many ways from the earlier language of mystical theology, that God is a mystery who wants to be known. So how do we go about knowing God? And mystical theology is all about that. How do we in this life enter a deep relationship with God? And what impact does that have on us? And how does that transform us? But by the 18th and 19th century, it starts being seen as people that are on the edge of society, that the mystics are loners, they're the oddballs, they're not the mainstream, they're uncommon, they've got experiences that are extraordinary, that are not part of everyone's experience, et cetera, et cetera. So it becomes quite exclusive in that way. And by the 20th century, it changes again, and it's again used for the idea of people having a deep spiritual understanding, but it's also used as a wide, like in a wide sense, to refer to a wide range of people across religious traditions. And so in the 20th century, the discipline of spirituality emerges as an academic discipline. And together with that, when people look back, we start saying that mystics are people who have direct experiences of the divine, however they define it, and they try to help other people understand and enter into that experience as well. That's some of the background. But in an alternative sense, it's the language of mystery and its association with the early mystery religions means that it's a term that was also picked up by the esotericists, the occultists, and the alternative stream along those lines. And so if you speak to some people, they think of it as along those lines, as something to do with magic, something to do with the esoteric, something to do with the occult, as opposed to do with the presence of God and intimacy with God. So we can have this wide range of meaning that on one hand, if you use, people come across the word mystic, it's like a Doctor Strange from a Marvel movie, as opposed to you come across the word mystic, well, there's mystics in every religion and they're all experiencing the same thing, some people might argue. And others will say, no, there's a distinct mystical theology, which is about the experience of the divine who is God. And God is actually a person as opposed to an impersonal divine out there. So the ideas vary quite a bit, and that makes it quite challenging. The idea of urban mystic, at least as I coined the phrase yonks ago, was in contrast to the desert mystics. Towards the end of the first century and into the second century, you've got a whole bunch of people giving up on society, but not just giving up on society, they actually decide to pursue a deep connection with God, and they leave the city to go into the desert. So by 340 AD, the first institution is created, and that's the institution of the monastery, where everyone that went into the desert together discovered that you don't live for very long in the desert alone without people that you're working together with. And so they found ways to be alone together, and then after that, they found ways to live in community with people that were sharing the same ideals. That's the tradition that started with the desert fathers and ended up with the monasteries. With that, there was a strong distinction between the normal kind of life that people would have and what became the spiritual life. The spiritual life was one where you left the world behind. You left your career behind, you left the institutions of faith behind, and you went to go be cloistered in some monastery. And spirituality was a retreat from life and a retreat from everything else. And so in some ways, there's a lot to be processed around that, because the kind of spirituality that we're looking at now is about living this life and living this life to the full. So there's a strong contrast there, because as opposed to withdrawing from life and as opposed to living unconsciously and just hanging on by a thread to go through life, it's a choice to live consciously and to actually practice deeper living and loving. And so there's a couple of different contrasts here, but the idea of the urban mystic is that it's about individuals living in modern cities and towns like we do today, and not separating between us and our life, and not primarily practicing abdication from life and withdrawal from things, withdrawal from the enjoyments of life, withdrawal from relationships, withdrawal from careers, et cetera, et cetera. We're actually seeing a strong dovetailing between this life that we're called to live, because this is the life that we're made for. And so this life is a spiritual life. So how do we enter deeply into it? And that's in the context of our cities, our towns, our homes, our marriages, our relationships with our kids, our loved ones, ourselves, et cetera. And so in my mind, the urban mystic is someone who's entering deeply into living and loving in the context of their life in the here and now. And so it's not about the esoteric. It's not about the occult. It's not necessarily about there being hidden secrets that aren't available to anyone, to the general masses. You know, it's not a mystery religion in that sense. So this is something that's available to all, and it's primarily rooted in our relationships.
I'm immediately intrigued by the idea of this Greek term, the mystikos thing, you know, thing that is a mystery or that is hidden. And I think to myself, what a wonderful framework from which to think into relationships. Intimacy is a process in a way, in a very simple way, if I think through that now, which is a revealing, you start in mystery when you meet someone. You and I started in mystery when we met each other. We had no idea who each of us were. And somewhere there was a click in the first meeting. There was a bit of an eye roll and a bit of a, okay, and a connect. And the more we started to disclose of each other, then something started to form out of that. And that's the first thought. And I don't know if that kind of tracks with mystics, but definitely for me, a relationship starts, but it also moves in a way towards a hiddenness and a mystery. And an intimacy is not necessarily something that you do. I mean, nuance this carefully. Intimate things are not things that you necessarily do in the middle of the town square. And sometimes they are. So they're hidden and they're available. And there are moments of intimate connection with someone with whom you are intimate where there is a hiddenness and a withdrawal. It's interesting. I was talking with a set of parents this week around their child who's 20, and talking about kind of the infatuation period with young people when they fall in love, and the parents trying to wrap their head around, like, the feeling I get from my child is that they want to just lock themselves in a room for like 2 years with this person and only this person and just disappear. How is that possible? To which I respond and go, you never felt that when you were young? When you met someone amazing and special and interesting and whatever, and you thought, just me and you, and we'll just disappear off somewhere. And there's this kind of, it's just us and it's intimate and it's hidden and we withdraw and there's that. But also, relationship between two persons doesn't flourish when it's cut off from everything else. And so it is this expansive moving out into the world of these two lives that expand individually, but also connect. And express together, and there can be moments of expressed intimacy in public, as there can be moments of hidden intimacy. And so you kind of start in this mystery and get to know each other, and you move in a way away from mystery into knowing. And there's a bit of a paradoxical expression there between knowing means, you know, some sort of cognitive knowing as well, but there's an experiential knowing. But you also create more mystery as you go along. Because there's kind of this is going somewhere and we're connected, but also some questions of, well, where is this going? And even I myself, as I get to know myself, there is a growth in knowing, but I am also a mystery. And I come to new realizations of, oh, wow, okay, didn't know that was in me, that strength, or that, you know, some sort of more overtly negative aspect or whatever. And so I get to know myself more and become more intimate with myself. But there is also this mystery aspect of things that are hidden that become revealed. And I think I was also thinking about, you know, one of my favorites and yours, I think, Esther Perel, the relationship therapist, who talks about this kind of relationships are this paradoxical mixture of separateness and togetherness, of revelation and knowing and mystery. And if you find the right cocktail of mystery and some, search out something within me, within the other person, and knowing, which provides kind of more and more of a basis for the relationship, you get quality over the longer term. And that was some of the thoughts that came to me as you were talking about mystery. And I thought, that's really, really fascinating.
There's such a good parallel, especially between like psychology, like Jungian psychology, the notion that we each have this deep self, which is actually hidden from us. We come into an awareness that there's a deeper part to ourselves that's not being fulfilled by the way that we've thought that we would be when we grew up and we started out in life. And so there's this point where we realize that actually the who I am that I thought that I knew is someone that I still need to discover. So I think our fundamental nature is hiddenness. It's mystery in relation to ourselves. So there's a going into the depths of ourself and therewith an intimacy of ourself. And so we can think of the ways in which we can avoid or hide from ourselves or hide ourselves from others as opposed to reveal who we are. When we think of our friendships or we think of our working relationships, we don't always think of them as intimate relationships because that deeper who we are doesn't really matter as much. We're sharing in a hobby or we're sharing in a working activity together. When it comes to an intimate relationship with someone that we know, that it's actually someone that we see and we look at someone and we say, actually, there's a hidden you as well. And I want to know that you behind the you, deep within the you.
And if we're really connected with that mystical experience, we will move to the hidden you rather than trying to retain previous versions of knowing of the person and hold them captive, right? As well, there's the, you are also still a mystery that's becoming. And if I'm really brave in the relational manifestation of that, you and I, we will push further and further into that mystery as well of your, as where you start with that inner self, that inner knowing, connection, intimacy. Carry on.
My intimacy with myself takes me so far, and then I can open up to another. If they don't want to know me deeper, that means that I might stop trying to know myself deeper or stop revealing myself deeper with them. And so intimacy's got this interplay between moving towards hiddenness and moving towards self-disclosure, moving towards hiding from myself, moving towards discovering myself. And so I think in many ways, this thing that we landed on, especially with season 5, was that there's an interplay between our fundamental human-to-human relationship and the human-to-divine relationship, where in our relationship with God, we can equally leave God captive to our theology or captive to our religion, captive to what society teaches us. And therefore, we don't actually want to enter into the knowing or the unfolding of the divine mystery in relation to us. And we don't want to disclose ourselves to the divine. I think of the one course that I run on the key relationships that we have. And part of the notion that I put forward there is that even as we've got these masks or persona that we wear in relation to others in society, we wear those in relation to ourselves too and in relation to the divine. And so it's very important to discover what those are and to recognize that this process of self-disclosure, the self process of self-discovery is not easy. It's hard won. And it's actually at the cost of the life that we have, because we can be dissatisfied in life, realize that we need to discover who we are and what we really want. And we can turn away from that to actually just have the life we've got. Or we can turn to our deeper self and have the life we've got at a deeper level. Or in doing that, we might just lose the life that we have as well. So this is not a neutral thing. It's a tremendously dangerous and challenging thing. And yet I'm convinced that apart from entering this depth, how can we really have a true deep quality of life.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. That's why I've adopted the phrase all relationship is risk, because to allow that forward momentum in to the unveiling mystery, to the pressing into the hiddenness, into the disclosure, whether it's self to self, self to other, being receptive of other to self, you know, I would just make sure to retain both directions on that. And then also self to divine, divine to self is incredibly risky. I think it's why we curate our own and others' stories so poorly, because it's complete risk management all the time. It's risk aversion. But there is, I feel, and I feel that experience within myself, and I feel as though I see it in others, there is then there's a paucity, a poorness to that we then risk quite a thin band of qualitative relationship where we could risk further. But it's costly. Costly to self, costly to the other, costly in the relationship. It's costly to the stories that we tell. We have to drop parts and allow space for it to grow and evolve. Again, even there is an emergence, perhaps from the hiddenness. And it takes place, yeah, all the time in the here and now. That's, and I pick up on the urban mystic. For me, what I love about that is that it captures think of Rob Bell's "everything is spiritual" statement. It's not that I have to withdraw to somewhere geographically special, or, you know, it's meant to be everywhere, to experience it everywhere, to infiltrate everywhere, to be experienced everywhere. And it's experienced differently in different places, I think. But I love the idea is that this is, you don't just do intimacy in a couple when you're on the couch doing couples counseling with a therapist. You can also do it in the midst of a fight, in the midst of a fight with your kids, in a shopping center. You know, if I think through that kind of thing, and then I think again, it's, you know, like the religious aspect for me in a way wants to contain rather than go, well, then yes, the self to divine relationship, divine to self relationship takes place in the shopping center, the middle of the life. And I think it's the pressing onwards and onwards into the awareness affects the quality, the depth, the risk one takes into further and further and deeper expressions of that relationship.
You used a phrase earlier about carefully curating stories of others.
I've sort of borrowed this loosely from Brené Brown. She's a US-based sociologist. I've heard her talk about the narratives that we use for ourselves and for relationships in this sort of two-sided way. And it's so simple. And I love that because it's such a simple, easy tool to get going with. There is a story I tell myself about myself. That story I inhabit, I live in, I experience. But the reason I tell that story to myself about myself is because it takes me places. So it allows me to express myself, to reach goals, to fulfill needs, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes I get stuck in that story, and it's because there are elements that I would say are less true. Be careful with that word truth, but are less true. So, for example, I realize I've been doing a lot of digging into my own family of origin over the last 6 months and a bit longer. And I realized just how much I've internalized an unintended, I think, message from my own mother, which was, you're easy to leave. You're easy to abandon. I lost my mom when I was 12, but when I've spent more and more time in this story, I realize I lost her twice, if not more, in my life. I lost her when I was 7, when she was diagnosed with the cancer that eventually ended her life. And she went immediately into a very difficult patch of sickness and all sorts of stuff. And 5 years later, she physically died. And that left me with a very deep impression of, yeah, well, I'm out of here. And that is a piece of my story that, when I look at it, has been tremendously unproductive, unhelpful, unhealthy for me, because it infiltrates into every element of who I am and how I behave. It has something to do with how I have been in relationships, telling myself I'm here, I'm in, both feet in, and realizing in retrospect, one foot's in and I'm leaning on the back foot. But then I'm telling myself the story that I'm there, and I'm using that story to then interpret other people's actions. And when they leave, oh, surprise, surprise, you see? That confirms I'm easy to leave. But I bring something into that space because I've internalized the script that says, you're easy to leave, and therefore I will abandon you, and therefore most likely others will. And when I can pause and look at that element of my story, I can engage with it in a different way, and I can actually make some choices around, I mean, is this accurate? Again, I'm careful of the word truth, but is this really true? Is there a deeper level of truth? I had a very emotional moment with my mum's elder brother and his wife just a couple of weekends ago. Part of my exploration, I did a call with them to talk through some of what they remember of her. And my aunt, my mother's brother's wife, suddenly at some point in the conversation, she just said, hey, you know, your mom didn't want to leave you. You know that, right? And it really pierced me right to the core. And it was immediately emotional because I don't know that. I don't know that. But as I stay in curating my own story, I realize I've latched onto something, and I don't think that that's helping. And I don't think it's true, but it was how I experienced it. But now I'm able to deal more gently and perhaps let go of that. And so I need to pay attention to the story I inhabit, because it's everything about my life. And I love that modality of story. The other side of the coin is that I have a story that I tell myself, and again, that orientation is important, about another. And so whoever I participate in relationship with, essentially I tell myself the story about who they are. And in the same way that I have to pause and allow myself editing rights on that story, in the story I tell myself about the other, I have to pause and also edit, but also allow them to edit. And so it becomes this collaborative process around reveal yourself to me, and I will work hard to pay attention and to stay up to, I will keep pace with that. And that's risky, because the story I might tell myself within the first year is, you think I'm amazing and there's nothing I can do wrong. And at a year's thing, suddenly you are telling me there's some things I can do wrong. And so I can stick to my old story and say, no, Tim, you can't tell me that there's things that I can do wrong. That's not how I know you. Or I can allow you to move out of a hiddenness in a way into something new and say, no, there's another element here, and I can edit the story that you hold for me. And you also need to allow that to happen. We need to collaborate on that. And I think that's incredibly, incredibly risky. It really is. To risk really becoming more and more this emergence of selfhood is unbelievably risky. And sometimes it feels like having something very solid in your hands, and then suddenly you have empty hands because you've let go of a piece of the story. And sometimes it really takes empty hands before something new can come. But it could feel like 1 second or 10 seconds or 10 years, I don't know, of a bit of an emptiness. And I know I don't like that, and it's my experience of human beings as well, as we don't deal well with that. But the benefit out of that is that we can move forward, we can grow, we can develop, etc. And the same in relation to the other, whoever it is we don't try and hold them captive to the story. And then that's also risky, because sometimes that means a change in the relationship. Sometimes it means an opening. Sometimes it means a tearing. Sometimes it means conflict. Sometimes it means all sorts of things that actually I think requires a greater and greater capacity, patience, kindness, generosity, all that sort of stuff. And I think more and more, I feel more and more as well that that is really what is happening in the self to self, the self to other, self to divine sort of trinity there. Is that if we can curate those better and not curate it from a fear-based or a risk-averse-based orientation, then we can press into that mystery, you know, if I borrow that again from you, that hiddenness, and forge something new, which is quite challenging and quite scary at times, but can also be incredibly life-giving and beautiful and special. And
gosh, I'm going to start off just by saying thank you for being so vulnerable and for sharing that. I don't want you to do you a disservice in responding, but I feel like that there's so much that's highlighted there about how I think arriving at this side of life, like we're on the older side of life now.
Yeah, just don't say on the way out, but yeah,
not on the way out. We're on that turning point. You know, we're on the second half, right? It brings to home that we've got stories that we have about ourselves that mean that we actually have a broken relationship with ourselves. That we're trying to get to know ourselves for real at a point in our life that we realize that our relationship is broken. That somehow we formed and inherited this relationship with ourselves and it's broken. And we're relating to others out of brokenness. We're relating to other people and to the divine out of that. And they're doing the same. You know, the story of God's a broken story. It's a broken relationship. It's a relationship that starts in absence and with distance. If for a relationship to be secure, it means that it's founded on someone being there for you and being responsive to your needs and to you calling out, then our relationship with God is a broken relationship because we start off with a sense or we discover God to be absent in a crisis. And then we said, did we ever really know God? And for most of us, the answer is no. And the same with our loved ones. We hit crises and, you know, where are they and who is there for us? And same with ourselves. You know, we hit crisis. We start discovering, who am I really? You see how you behave in a crisis. You see how you behave long term, how things add up. There's a tremendous amount that's here. And I think there's no wonder that the spiritual greats speak so often about this awareness of self and reflection. Taking time to reflect on behavior, taking time to reflect on our engagement with others, taking time to reflect on how we're reacting versus how are we acting, and what's the difference between the two? Is our acting real? Are we acting correctly? And when we're reacting, that's also showing us what we are. And so we can live with this duality where I'm doing good, my intentions are good, but I'm reacting badly, or I react well and I do badly because I misunderstand. Again, it's related to the stories that we're in. And so in many ways, I think you're highlighting something incredible there, that we hold on to these stories. When it comes to religions, at least with what I'm working with at the moment, I contrast what I call these three greatest stories: the Hinduisms, the Buddhisms, the theisms. And then within the theisms, I contrast the three great theisms: Judaism, Christianity, Islam. And they each say something fundamentally different. They tell us a different story about who we are as people. And they tell us a different story about who we are or who the divine is. And those stories are related. Human and the divine reflect each other in many ways. I think the details of that is something for another time, but I'm deeply aware of how people have these stories about who they are, that they're trying to tell everyone. And then there's the stories that they'll tell in private to a loved one. And that's where intimacy, that's an expression of intimacy, something deeper unfolding. It's very important that we find safe spaces to tell our stories, and that we become safe spaces for others to tell their stories. And in that sense, we become, you know, can we also become a safe space for the divine to tell their story to us? And that's something I'm interested in. And I know many religious people are very averse to this because I feel like we've got a book. We could build a legal case as to who God is, and blah, blah, fish based, or, you know, people tell these stories again around that keep us locked away from relational engagement. I mean, I know when a relationship breaks and I really want to be out of a relationship with someone, I don't like them anymore, I hold a story about something that they did, and that eclipses who they are in my mind, or perhaps even who they've been. There's ways in which we tell stories that actually break relationships and keep them broken, and we do that to keep ourselves safe and distant from others. And it's very hard to get away from the stories that people tell about us. And it's very hard for us to get through the stories that we tell others about ourselves. And it's very hard in private to get away from the story of who we tell ourselves we are.
Yeah, really so much. And I mean, one of the things that strikes me there that I see kind of week in and week out at the moment is I would contrast, or at least juxtapose, control alongside protection, because you talk about kind of protecting ourselves, and there's an element of control that we express, and you talk about, I know that feeling so well, in a breaking relationship or broken relationship, you just zone in on one or two areas and you maximize it, and that becomes the story, or it eclipses or whatever. And it's such a control orientation towards, okay, I have some power now, and there we go. And I'll just curate with this because it'll take me somewhere. And at the same time, juxtaposed alongside that is, it is a protection stance. There is an aversion to pain and the discomfort, etc., of what's happening there. Sometimes just what's happening within me in relation to this relationship and perhaps my own part or whatever that might be. I think relationships thrive with self-control, but they don't thrive so well of control of other. And when we use those stories to try to control each other, that's where relationship really dies. And that's some of how I think of like religious institution, for example. Go and sit with any great therapist and they can give you some hallmarks of what a good relationship is like. And they can give you some of the boundaries and the goals and it's fantastic. I mean, it's good stuff. It's good stuff. They can even tell you stories about clients they've worked with. And if they really, at least in my opinion, if they're moving far more towards a person-oriented therapeutic approach, they might even tell you a couple of their own stories. But that's still not your story until you take all of that sort of stuff that you can gain from that framework and go and do it yourself in relationship. And I see, again, I know we've talked about this so many times, religious institution uses that kind of control around other people's stories with the divine, the elements of what a relationship with the divine could look like, etc. And then this rigidity and this control sets in. No mysteries allowed. No hiddenness is allowed. No expansion, no experience. All of that is too risky and doesn't allow enough control. And that's very scary. So let's just protect by closing all of that off and not participating in the stories or the expansion of the story, participate in this level of story, and we'll stick with that. We'll stick with that. And I think that's where relationship goes to die. And I think it's why so many people who have experienced and want to continue to experience deep relationship with self, with others, and especially with self and the divine, find religious institutions really hollow places. Because it's very clear that when you come up, you bump up against that and you taste it, that's where relationship goes to die. And I think healthier expressions can have somewhat of a supportive self to other and self to self expression. But I really think if we try too hard to curate God's story, that I think that's where the relationship can go to die, because I don't think it thrives there.
Find in religious environments, the idea of God or an experience of God is so legally gatekept that you can't easily share your experiences because you're going to actually be jumped on. The language you use is wrong. The experience doesn't match someone else's experience. It doesn't line up to some text, et cetera, et cetera. It gets gatekept in so many different ways that you can't be authentic about where the relationship is. Because I also think of intimacy as the difference between sharing of information, as sharing about things that are in the past or in the future, something that's out there, versus moving to an in-the-moment relating. In the moment, a report, a feedback, an encounter, an engagement between people, as in, what are you feeling? What are you experiencing now? And in religious environments, often it's a then story. It's not a now story. You know, and your now story, you've got to be very careful. Your now story has got to match that then story. But it's not the then story that was, it's the then story that's told in a community. And that can be very challenging. And so healthier environments are ones where the enjoying of the relating is allowed to be, where there's flexibility to grow, to evolve. There's flexibility to not be who you were, but to be who you can become, and who you, and where there's a flexibility to want to discover who someone is in the live process as they're discovering who they are. We, you know, our intimate close people are the people that we actually discover what's wrong with them. We discover what's right with them. We discover the idea of who they want to be and how they're not that yet, or how they've stopped being something, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And in that entering into the depth, we can actually nurture people and see them grow and blossom into the fullness of who they're discovering themselves to be. But it can also be relationships where we lock people down. And I think there's no better example of it than this time of year, where people often get together with their families. And one of the things that we so often get to see is that the minute those families get back together, people fall back into old patterns and roles. They don't understand it. They're deeply frustrated. I mean, it's one of the reasons why my fun sports was meeting and seeing people together with their family and their parents, especially because the minute they get together in those groups, they fall back to exactly who they are. And you can see so much of what it is in your relationship with them. That's like, oh, okay, this person now makes sense to me because I've seen them in the constellation that a large part of their makeup still is defined by. And even though I've experienced them apart from that, part of their freedom to discover and explore is because they're broken away from that. And yet, how do they bring that back? And so yeah, it's a challenging thing. I also think of how in spirituality, so much of our spirituality is about giving things up and moving away rather than entering deep in. You hear people speaking about fasting. You don't hear people as easily speaking about celebrating. You know, people will break a fast, but they won't be entering into the enjoyment of food. You know, it's like you're allowing something back. You're not actually going into the fullness of it, you know, and we can think of that on many different levels. And so, you know, we've often got this idea of retreat-based spirituality, which is holiday stuff. It's withdrawal stuff. When we talk about love in the spiritual context, we abstract it. We throttle life out of it. It's a universalized love that has no needs. It's got no wants. It just allows anyone to be whoever and whatever they are and just love them as they are. It loses that depth of eros, of desire, you know, the kind of desire that is moved to pain and moved to joy by how well someone is doing in life, that's moved in and out of relationship, even by how someone behaves or responds or shows up or doesn't show up or abandons you. You know, it's the kind of relationship where someone, you know, as you referred earlier, that, you know, you see a certain kind of, at a certain stage of intimacy, or people withdrawing from everything to spend time with each other because that's such a rich new discovery for them. And then there's another stage of intimacy where on that connection that they've got, they're discovering each other out in the world and in relationships out with other people too. You know, they're no less intimate for us, but now there's a different kind of discovery and journey that takes place there. And that's so different to that abstracted kind of love that moves away, that basically says, well, you can move off and I'll love you. You can come here and I'll love you. You can abandon me and I'll love you. And there is a certain universal dimension that I think is incredible. And it's very important that we all attain that in ourselves and that we have that kind of universal love for everyone. But I do think that the depth, certainly if we go to the biblical image, you know, especially the Song of Songs, for instance, gives us the notion that the ultimate expression of spirituality between the divine and the human is of that lover, that loved and beloved in depth of intimate pursuit of each other, and that longing, that desire.
Yeah, the demanding as well.
Yeah, exactly, the demanding, the showing up with needs and wants, the asking, the taking. Yeah. And yet somehow in our spirituality, we've moved to the idea of God as this universal, I don't know if you can use the word lover without bringing in desire, because that universal abstracted love is not a lover.
Imagine yourself into a person-to-person relationship with someone, and you're like, hi, I'm here to see you. And they're like, oh, nice. Hey, I'm leaving and I'm not coming back tomorrow. Oh, nice. Come to the shops with me. Let's go and have a meal. Oh, nice. Leave me alone. I'm going to be on my own. Oh, nice. Show me some need. Show me some desire. Show me some anger. Show me some fear. Show me some passion. Show me. You know, I find that language so good. Show me. No, you can't touch me. You can't reach me. Can I be reached by you? Can I move you with my wants, my needs, my desires, my demands, my rejection? Does something happen to you? Or are you also just going to, you know, and there's no kind of tussle. There's no back and forth. There's no dynamic there it's just a static, passive kind of, yeah, those are, I don't see that as the rewarding relationship. I mean, it's something, but does it really move towards kind of how I would have a sense of the great stories is that dynamic is, and if I even look at the people participating, if I look through kind of just the Christian scriptures participating in some of that, I see dynamic. I don't see static. I don't see passive. And I think, how on earth do you arrive at this universal love if I'm now one with the universe and I love everything without ever having loved something, someone, a particular? Is how is that even possible?
Yeah, I think, I mean, referring to the scriptures in that sense, it's referring to the God who has that abstracted kind of love for everything and yet is moved to passionate love and connection with individuals. And out of the fullness of that love is able to enter more deeper into that passionate love rather than the abandonment of the passionate love for a universal love that has no passion.
Yes, there's an interplay, yeah, and in the Christian story of the Gospels with the person of Jesus, there is a sense of a loving connection and giving to the masses, the crowds, the many, and these other one-to-one, one-to-three, smaller group, more intimate expression of, you know, of relationship moments. There is that interplay, which is so fascinating. And so to collapse into, I mean, you mentioned retreat thing, and the first thing that comes to mind is, and I think this is also partly what you're saying, is retreat is not such a bad thing, but retreat is a terrible all-encompassing thing. So how do we get to be lovers only when we're on some kind of couples retreat or, you know, in some therapeutic mediation or, I don't know, just in the bedroom? The rest of the time, we don't get to be that. We're just passive, all being, I don't know. I mean, that doesn't work. But sometimes it's good to take a moment out. Sometimes it's good to retreat. Sometimes it's, and again, there is dynamic there, you know, as opposed to, and self-denial. Love does not exist without self-denial. To meet needs is sometimes to go, okay, well, you want to go to a movie? I want to go for a walk. Neither of those needs we will allow to diminish. It's not that one trumps another. It's that now we express towards each other, how do we go about mutual reciprocity? So maybe that means I self-deny the walk today and we do the movie. And tomorrow you self-deny the movie and we do the walk. And that's how we meet each other in that kind of the back and forth of love. But where there's needs going on and one is in self-denial and the other one is in gratification, that relationship doesn't exist, or it ceases to exist over time. And if it does continue, its quality diminishes and diminishes and diminishes until we can't really use the word relationship anymore, because it's not. And so all of those elements again have to be within the dynamic rather than the passive, the static, the just, I like that word you use, meh, universal. It's just, there's no flavor there. There's no nothing. But it is safe. And by safe, I mean controllable, simpler, more easy to rationalize, which again is often a control-oriented thing, where love is a bit like a wildfire. It's very hard to control sometimes, and that's why we have impassioned moments and over-the-top moments and all the rest. And it is easier to just collapse back to just control this, make it simpler, make it easy. I have my story of you, and that's as far as we go. I have my story of me. That's as far as I go. And I think the invitation is there is to go forward. But it asks a lot, I think. I keep coming back within my mind to this picture of Moses in the Old Testament going up the mountain and coming down. And he should have said to the masses, if you want it, it's up there. Because it's going to cost a lot. You know, it really, really does.
I think of it as such a rich missed opportunity. of a group of people that have been brought to an encounter with God, and their response is to say, nope, we're going to hide behind you. Why don't you go on our behalf? You know, let's see if you survive. You know, this is a dangerous thing to do. In many ways, we do still hide. It seems to be in our nature to hide, that hiding is a big part of what we do. Yeah, I think one of the things that we're going to have to tackle is this phrase of entering deeper into living and loving. The question of so what does it look like? Because on one hand, there's the ways in which, yeah, how do I put it? I think that there's a lot of parallels between those three. And we can see a lot about how we feel in our human to human relationships will carry through to our human to divine relationship. It's very natural that if you don't know someone, if they come into your space, you're going to withdraw from them. A lot of people seem to feel that when the divine, when God shows up, it should feel natural. And their first reaction is to hide and move away. And therefore, that can't be God, or this is not right. And I think that's how I thought, I should say. That's originally how I thought about it. And I've known others to think about it that way too. Whereas when I've spent a long time with someone, and they move close to me in conversation or even move close to me physically, my reflex is to lean into them. And just on that simple continuum of a stranger, my reflex is to pull away. With someone that I know and love, my reflex is to lean in. You know, just on that, if we found several different threads like that, there's many different threads that we can find and explore in relation to this around our human to divine experience. Because for the most part, I feel like, you know, I still think back and, you know, in my undergrad studies, I had to do spirituality. It was one of my subjects. And I did really well with it, but I faked my diary, I faked my self-reflections, all that kind of stuff, because I considered that a waste. I mean, I was young. Like, what did I know? You know, I grew up a little in life. But back then, I didn't understand how significant spirituality was, because I also didn't understand how significant relationship was. You know, I'd grown up in a very hard environment where emotion was not welcome. And how I survived was I didn't have emotions. I shut myself off from my needs and wants. And then I looked down on people because they had them and they expressed emotion and they got upset. And it's like, oh, come on, I can look down on you. Like, are you that weak? Are you that pathetic? And it took a long time for me to break through that. And it took a number of different encounters with God to break through that too. Number of different intimate personal encounters that were awful. Not just awful in the AWEFUL, like, oh, well, full of wonder and awe and that kind of stuff, but awful in the sense of like they were horrible experiences. You know, like the one story that I told in an earlier podcast episode about being hugged by God and the trauma of that and wanting to run away. And yet that being a loving action that broke through something for me and transformed something in me. You know, there were lots of experiences like that have had me come around to the notion that spirituality and relationship are so deeply intertwined. And yet for years, even within a movement like I'd been a part of, the notion of intimacy with God's not being fulfilled because of the way words have been translated and used. And so for instance, you know, just to refer to it, John Wimber speaks of the numinous. He's drawing on the Old Testament image of the Shekinah, of the presence of God is weighty, it's tangible. There's the notion of the manifest presence of God and finding language for it. So he borrows from Rudolf Otto, he borrows the word numinous, a German theologian from the 1930s, his book, The Idea of the Holy. And in that, Otto is wrestling with this, and he offers us this word of numinous. And it's in an era where people are wrestling with mystical experiences. And they've opened up and they're looking at the experiences that people have of different kinds. Because you don't only have theistic experiences that are considered mystical or deep or spiritual. You've got other experiences as well. And he's saying there's this unique thing within theism. There's this encounter with this other. And what is this? And so he coins this phrase of numinous, of what it's like to stand in the presence of God, what it's like to experience God. And so when Wimber's working with that and he offers the books Power Healing and Power Evangelism, which were radically transformative in my earlier years, it was the first time I encountered language that approximated the encounters with God that I had. And yet I still didn't have access to the deep ideas of intimacy and relationship. but I'd never experienced those deep. I hadn't at that point in life experienced those deep relationships. It took some life experience to get there. But back then, Wimber offers the notion of numinous, and he basically speaks and says, if you don't understand the word numinous, just ignore it and just write presence next to it. But then he doesn't translate it as presence consistently transitions to power. And you see the way that that language of the power encounter with God has come to define Vineyard churches, where it's tacked on at the end of a service following the message for a power encounter. It's a space for there's a word or an image, something prophetic, and then people are going to be, you know, someone's going to encounter God. God's speaking to someone and God wants, you know, it's like a clash. It's like an engagement. That's okay as an introduction and a handshake. But it's got to move on beyond that towards intimacy. And so in many ways, I feel like within my own life, there was a journey from being a tremendously non-relational person who wasn't actually non-relational, was actually shut down due to abuse and trauma and couldn't relate because there was just so much backlog being held back. How do you relate when you've got that amount of trauma? You have to be shut down to a lot. You've got to shut yourself down to a lot. And therefore, you can't experience a lot in the moment either. One of the deep challenges I see a lot of people face is that as they start entering into this stuff, they start being present to all of that. And so to knock on one door of depth and intimacy, you've got to open up another. And if someone is getting deep and close to you, they're going to open up those doors and all of that stuff is going to come out in one way or another. And it's going to come out in relationship with ourself if we go there, with others if we go there, and with the divine if we go there. Yeah, I think that there's a lot in people's just backstory that significantly shapes them that they may not be aware of. And so I think that the notion of consciousness and presence is so vital to this. The question of can we be conscious with another? Can we be present to another and to ourselves with this, or do we get lost? And I think for a large part, we actually get lost. It's like learning to balance and getting on a skateboard for the first time. You're going to fall off. And I think when people get into the deeper spiritual stuff and into the deeper mystical stuff, there's a lot of falling off that takes place because we also don't understand that based on who we are coming into this, we're going to be falling into and out of relationship. Because our trauma can drive us to pursue relationship too hard and not understand what we're getting as relationship. And it can drive us to run away from what is coming to us because we don't see that as relationship. We see that as a threat to our identity and our health and our well-being. And that actually carries across into the relation of the divine as well. I just happened to be lucky with some of my earlier experiences where I was literally cornered and couldn't get away. and I say that flippantly now, but back then the inner experience was actually, no, I still have some of those feelings in it. Some of those feelings rising up, you know, those visceral feelings of reacting, of wanting to run away, wanting to hide, even just referring to it. And I think these are real things. And I think we've got an opportunity to pass some of this out, to develop it, to tease some of these ideas out and explore them.
I love the two words or two sort of things that come out of that to me that really, really grab me. I'll try and encase them in something. I love how you talk about the awful without the E. It's just uncomfortable and awkward and not great. And that's not actually what I'm asking for, perhaps. And the falling down. I love that. I read a book by Richard Rohr years ago called Falling Upwards. And the kind of premise there is for him, take life of 70 years, split it in half, roughly 35 in one direction, 35 in another direction in terms of your years of life experience. And he says we spend the first half of our life trying to build and build. And a lot of that, in his words, kind of the ego work. And we're trying to make something out of what we've got. And I would nuance that further and further these days with things that I'm learning and trauma that you refer to. That a lot of that ego work, which can be really kind of looked down on as in a very simple way, but it's actually an expression of survival in a way, of trying to hide, to cope, to protect, to get by. And we do it in very many complex ways. That the idea of the awful and the falling down is something we actively work against And it made me think of how many kind of religious institution experiences are built up around the comfortable and the fuzzy and the warm and the, and it's not that there's anything wrong with that. Every week at the moment, the first day of my working week, I get to sit with at least one other person, a complete stranger who I've never met before usually, and spend a good few hours paying very, very deep attention to their life story. It's where I start every single week. Tell me about your life, but take me back. Take me back into your family of origin. Tell me about your mother, your father, your siblings, your early experiences. And part of what I ask people to do is to pause and to be present in the falling down and in the awful, in the awkward, in the painful, in the uncomfortable, and to be present to some things that they've logged in a certain way in their life and just gone, oh, well, this is what it is, and perhaps be open to seeing that's part of their story in a different way, is perhaps that was trauma or abuse or hiding or a mask or a necessary protection at the time, but a protection, an aberration, an unhealthy, whatever it might be. It's the most amazing privilege to be able to be invited that deeply into people's journeys every single week. And that many, if not all of them, will trust me to say, okay, let's stay with that falling down, because maybe that's more significant than you think. And we do tend to rush towards the more comfortable and the warmer and the fuzzy and that sort of stuff. But I like how you talk about that the divine can come in and it can feel really horrible. Think about moments where I spend with my supervisor at the moment that I see once every 3 weeks or so. Man, she asks me to stop in some really, like, if I was driving home, I would not stop the car there kind of terrain. Like, this is a bad idea. We don't stop in this neighborhood for a very, very good reason. And she goes, hey, let's stop the car. Let's turn off the engine. Let's go outside and let's walk around. Don't worry, you're safe. Let's go see. Hell no, I'm not safe. This is crazy. I don't want to do this. This is madness. And so I have this direct experience a lot at the moment, and for me, and then as I do that with others, of this, yeah, let's lean into the awful. And it's not that I would think, I would not want to put forward as a principle, in the same way I see the religious institution doing kind of the opposite, that you need to look out for the awful. Okay, there we go. There's the real life, right? The living deeply, living and loving deeply. And by the converse, only look out for the warm, the comfortable, the fuzzy, and, you know, there, that's the principle. I think the principle is to be able to pause and to pay attention, to be really, really aware, to become more aware, to notice, to allow these things to be more and more of what they actually are. Like that story I tell myself about my mother, it was easy to leave me. That is a piece of town in myself that I have been avoiding for a long, 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 long time. It has been a hiddenness within me. And only in this year have I been ready to go drive to that part of town, get out of the car and walk around like I'm safe and go, maybe this is not what I thought it was, and just pay attention to what's going on. But it means confronting some real spaces of trauma in myself. And by confronting, I don't necessarily mean fighting so much as being slow. Yeah. Being generous, allowing, being kind to, you know, those kinds of things. And what comes out of that really blows my mind. And I would not have been able to script it for you if you'd asked me to up front. And yet I think about what the awful offers, you know, and that's partly what I think of when I hear you speak of your own story. I think, wow, this, when you talk about the awful, perhaps, of that hugging experience, and then you talk about kind of, I think you used the language of unlocking, if I remember correctly, and thinking, yeah, sometimes just paying attention, even to the awful, even to the falling down, unlocks something, opens something, allows us to move further into the mystery and paradoxically further into the knowing, which is such a fascinating interplay. And I love that idea that you talk about, the divine showing up is not just sunshine and rainbows and kittens and unicorns. Sometimes we get the fuck away. Don't touch. Right? Oh, that's just way too weird. Nope. But if you can pay attention and move into that hiddenness, that mystery, and to that knowing, so to feel there's things on the other side of that. But it really does mean like pushing the boat off into the darkness sometimes a little bit, but also sometimes into the light. It's quite something.
Yeah, and you know, you land on that pushing the boat off into the darkness and sometimes the light. And there's so much in mystical theology actually about entering into darkness that I think that phrase is exactly about. And then there's other things that are, I think, just poorly translated because it's an old word that meant something in that context. And when we use that word in this context, that doesn't mean the same thing. You know, like words like passivity is actually receptivity in better translation today, you know, that kind of stuff. So there's a lot to look back on and draw on as well. And I think one of the things that I'd like to see us doing, not necessarily these episodes as an interim season, but the season to come, is of building some kind of framework that people can work with, something that that can help them. Because, you know, you and I speak quite easily on a level. No, easily is not the right word. We speak with a sense of familiarity about engagement with God that comes out of our experience of engaging God. And a lot of people that I know and a lot of people that approach me and ask me about this are in the position of not having experienced God. And when they step forward to, they don't find God readily available there. And so that's another thing that we're going to need to put on the table to really process. And I think that's one of the reasons where I'm grateful that we've landed on this language of intimacy and this notion of there being someone present around, but us not being intimate in engagement with them. And so in this sense as well, it's not about whether people do or don't have a relationship with the divine. I think on the basis of the divine being creator and sustainer, there's a relationship that is inescapable, but it's not an intimate relationship. It's a non-relational relationship. And what we're speaking about is not, you know, and what a lot of other people speak about is of a faith relationship, that a profession of faith is a relationship. And I feel like, no, there's language to actually explore around that, to say that there's a faith as relationship paradigm that can be the story that keeps us from an actual relationship. And then there's another thing related to the postmodern idea of God, where God is phenomena, but God is not a someone, that I think is quite an intense concept that I'd also love to see us unpacking and delving into, because there the divine's a mystery, which is like the horizon. Every step you take, it moves further away because it's so big you can never reach it or encompass it. And that's not the same as the divine being someone who steps forward from beyond mystery, who wants to be known. You know, the analogy falls short in this context, and yet in the postmodern philosophical sense, it displaces all other concepts of God and the personhood of God and this kind of relationality. And it does that through a language game that I think is very important to acknowledge in order for us to find our way past it and for us to also draw the benefits of it, because a large part of that faith as relationship paradigm is actually what they're describing. And it's fair to acknowledge that and say, well, if that is the case, then there is a way past that, but the way past that is actually quite a challenging process. And no matter the degree to which we have an idea, we're always having to release our ideas. And as you say, not just curate our stories, but update them and edit them in real time with what someone else is revealing to us. And I think often that's not what's taking place in the context of spirituality and religion. And that hints another need for the kind of venture that we're on and sharing in.